Oh, well, it's not really the I Love Ann show. It's not really Meet Me at the Diner, but it is a very special presentation today. I am very fortunate and very blessed to have sitting right across from me on the table here at Sharp Facets Gallery, Congressman Jim Clyburn. How are you doing today?
I'm just fine. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we appreciate it. It's great. Yeah. You brought your wife, Emily, with you.
Absolutely.
And yeah, she's out there enjoying the jewelry store as we speak, Jim.
I hope not too much.
Well, yes, I hope she does find something while she's here.
I'm sure you do.
But we're not really talking politics today, but we are going to talk about your book. Yeah. And I think that I've spent a lot of time reading it. I didn't get through the whole book, but I'm very impressed with the book.
Thank you.
Love the down-to-earthness of it.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. My intentions in writing this book was for it to be informative, be enjoyable, be understandable. In fact, I applied a test after every chapter. As you know, I started my professional career as a public school teacher. Mm-hmm. I taught world history at the 10th grade level in the Charleston County Public Schools. And I was teaching back when the Bay of Pigs occurred, when Kennedy was assassinated. And it occurred to me that you are not doing good by your students if you would be talking about the Fertile Crescent and they are reading about the Bay of Pigs.
Mm-hmm.
So I changed my way of teaching, and I applied that method to writing this book. And so I would ask myself after every chapter, would those 10th graders I used to teach understand what I just wrote?
Mm-hmm.
Would they get anything out of what I just wrote? Would they be motivated by what I just wrote? And if I could not answer those three questions in the affirmative, I went back and rewrote. And in one or two instances, I deleted stuff because I wanted this book to be a book that would allow people to get some insight into what it is to be a Southerner, what it is to be to grow up black in the South, and how you maneuver and how you work your way through those things, and hopefully make some modicum of success out of your life.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think it's very interesting. You didn't happen to have your granddaughter read any of it for you and tell you what she thought of it, did you?
No, I didn't. In fact, I did not want them to read it. I kept it away from both my grandchildren. I have a grand who just finished his second year of college. In fact, he's going back up to Washington with me next week. He's going to spend the summer working up there. And my other grand is a rising senior in high school. Well, I have another grand who's just 2 years old. But I didn't want them to read it until I finished it. I wouldn't, in fact, I didn't let my wife read it.
You didn't let your wife read it?
No. No, I didn't.
Wow.
My brother, Charles did. My brother John didn't. I wanted the book to be me. And
you didn't want to be influenced by anybody?
No.
Yeah, I can see the chapter on your wife. I don't think that's exactly right, Jim.
That's exactly right. You know.
Yeah, exactly. I do.
I didn't want to have to change anything.
Yeah. But, you know, speaking of that, you had a dear friend who was helping you write the book.
Right.
And then, in fact, what were you, two-thirds through the book or something?
About two-thirds through when he passed away. Phil Gross, many
speechwriter,
of your listeners would remember him. Phil was a speechwriter for Bob McNair, John West. He really authored books on both McNair and West. And he told me that if I ever got serious about writing a book, he would be glad to help me professionally with it. And so what I would do, I would write my emotions, my feelings, and I would put it the way I thought it ought to be.
Right.
And then I would send it down to Phil. And Phil would go through it, and sometimes he would reorganize stuff, or you say, well, maybe you ought to say this a little differently. And then he would send it back to me. And then there were times when I had to delete some of his things because I often teased him. I said, now, this book has to be me, and what you just said sounds fine, except that it ain't the way I would say it.
Right.
And so we went through that a bit. But Phil passed away. He was a dear friend and close confidant. And when he passed away, I thought that that would be the end of this project. But then I remember my youngest brother, Charles, is a pretty good grammarian and pretty tough taskmaster. And I asked him, would he step in where Phil was? And he agreed to do that. And so I start sending stuff to Charles.
Now, there had to be a change, though, between dealing with Phil and dealing with Charles.
Big change.
Okay.
Phil was white. Charles was black. That was the difference.
He was your brother.
Charles, my brother. And we, I have two brothers. And we don't give in to each other. We are very close. Mm-hmm. We talk daily. In fact, my brother John has already called today. I'll be talking to him two or three times today. I talked to him, I think, three times yesterday.
And you're the oldest.
I'm the oldest.
Right.
I talked with Charles last night. You know, we just don't cut each other in a slack. And we argue. Phil and I used to discuss
right.
differences. Charles and I argued over differences. I mean, we would be 2 o'clock in the morning yelling at each other on the telephone as to why what I wrote was the right way to do it or the correct form.
Was there any question about who was remembering the story the right way?
No. I had pretty good notes and pretty good memory. The only big error that Charles caught was I kept referring to our grandmother as Elvira, which is my wife's grandmother's name. And I don't know why that got locked in my head. And then when Charles read it, he called me one night. He said, look, you're making a pretty big error in this book. I said, what's that? Elvira was not grandmother's name. Her name was Eveline. And I started to argue. I said, come
started to argue
yeah.
about it.
And then when he says her name was Eveline, and it hit me, yes, it was Eveline. And so I don't know, that would have been pretty embarrassing, I think, if my uncle, I still have two aunts and uncle, if I had referred to their mother by my wife's mother's name.
So in this case, it was good that Charles was on board with this project.
Yeah, and there's some other instances where I think he was good, in spite of the fact that I argued with him. There are a lot of times when I did exactly what he said.
Well, that's good. That's yeah. good. Now, I understand that the book was kind of wordy. They had
yes.
They made you cut it back.
Yes. When I submitted the book, I submitted 186,000 words. I didn't bother to read the contract. It's right in the contract with the University of South Carolina that it should be approximately 150,000 words. Well, I just forgot about that. I submitted 186,000 words. This is what I felt. It all flowed well. And they came back to me and told me that I needed to cut 36,000 words out of the book or it would change the whole character. As well as the price points on the book,
sure,
which would reduce readership.
Right.
And so I went back and it took me almost 2 years, but I went back through the book.
2 years?
Yes.
Wow.
I had to go through the whole book.
Right.
To cut stuff out, making sure the stuff lined up, and we got down to 150,000 words.
Wow. That's pretty awesome. That is pretty awesome. Now, you actually, you were telling me you used the Dragon Speak where you could talk to the computer or you typed.
Yeah, I did both.
A good typist, I understand.
I'm a pretty good typist. I'm not as fast as I used to be. I noticed that when I was my father, I have no idea why he did this. But when I was 13 or 14 years old, Mrs. Ivey, who was the business administration teacher at Lincoln High School in Sumter, used to teach private typing lessons in the basement of her home right there on Washington Street. And my dad would drive me every week to Ms. Ivey's house and bought me a typewriter. And so I learned to type. My dad, I was the first born, and therefore, he did a lot of stuff with me.
Well, you do that with your firstborn, don't
you? Yeah, absolutely. Because
the second and the third comes along, and you go, oh, well.
That's exactly right. John was 2 years younger, but John never learned to type. Charles, I don't think he learned to type to this day. I think he does okay with the computer, but he knows
not
the keyboard.
Same. Not the same.
I used to type pretty fluidly.
You know, in reading your book, one of the things that impressed me, or one of the things that I was thinking about, if you were going into politics today, okay, with the background, your mother was an entrepreneur extraordinaire,
right.
Your dad was a preacher
right.
and a carpenter, and it just looks to me like the background would be a very conservative background.
Well, it always has been. It was back then. I think that people tend to confuse conservatism with progressivism. I don't think, if you look at liberal as conservative, I think that somewhere in between all of that is being progressive on issues. And I am much more of a progressive than I am a liberal. I'm probably more liberal than I am conservative. But I think I tell in the book that my dad was very conservative. He was Republican, and he was, like everybody else, he was, all other blacks, a member of the party of Lincoln. And when I came along, I was a junior in college. I suspect maybe my senior year in college before I ever realized that I was not a South Carolina Republican. I thought I was a Republican. I went through school as one. But then all of a sudden I look at issues, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. I mean, how could I not be associated with the party that was pushing those things? And how could I be associated with the party that was against those things? If I ever had a son, I think his name would have been J. Everett.
J. Everett?
Yes.
Because?
J. Everett Dirksen.
I knew that's where you were going. Yep.
Leader of the Senate.
Yep.
Back in 1964 and 65. And it was J. Everett Dirksen who got with Lyndon Johnson to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And I admired him tremendously. And I said to my wife, if we ever have a son, I really would love to name J. Everett Dirksen. Now, it wouldn't have been, he was James Everett.
Right.
But our little deal was that J would be J-A-Y Everett.
You know, it's very interesting. On the second page of my notes, I have Senator Everett Dirksen to talk about with you.
Oh, yeah? Oh, that's great. That's great.
Because of his stand on universal, the standardized insurance.
Sure.
Yeah. And the commonality of spousal assets.
Sure.
And also money not to stop someone from going to college.
Absolutely.
That people could give community service instead of paying money, so they didn't come out of school with all this debt.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, and that's the kind of way that things were done in the late 50s, early 60s. And that's the kind of debate you had. It wasn't this thing about all or nothing.
Right.
You found ways to...
Common ground.
Common ground. Eric Dixon, I was so... I forgot what the issue was when he sort of left the reservation back around 1968. I was very, very disappointed when he began to get pushed far and far to the right. But I still admire him.
Absolutely.
And I was like, his son-in-law, Senator Baker, who succeeded him as a majority, or at least a Republican leader of the Senate, married his daughter. And I was fun. I got to know Senator Baker. I never knew Dirksen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never knew him personally
right.
But I got to know
him. Followed his
Baker.
Politics. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I just find that fascinating that was the second
great.
Page of my notes here.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
But,
good minds or great minds, whichever one, run together, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, I tell you what, let's see. We were talking about that issue, but one of the things that, did you have somebody that was who you looked up to that you would like to emulate your life after? When you were growing up?
Sure. My dad, I was very close to my dad. My dad, as you remember from some of the stuff in the book, my dad taught me all kinds of stuff about, he would set things up. It wasn't like he would sit down and say, let me teach you this. No. You
the string
would never know.
Story.
Yeah.
The story about
absolutely
the string.
Absolutely, the cord string. I mean, my brothers, the three of us being close in age, as I said, we're very competitive. To this day, one day the three of us were having a little physical discussion that some people might call a fight. My dad, we didn't know it, he was watching us. And after he thought that had gone on long enough, he called the three of us over to him. And he was sitting on the old drink crate, these little crates that you have.
You were at a gas station or something, getting your car worked on.
Had
or
my
something.
Dad's, my, yeah, well, Reverend Mr. Singleton,
right.
was working on my dad's car, and he was sitting there waiting on the car to get running for another week. And so, when he called us over, we were very anxious because we thought maybe we were about to be punished. And my dad had this cord string in his hand. And he gave the cord string to Charles. He said, Charles, I want you to pop this string. And Charles struggling, he couldn't pop it. He then took it back and he gave it to John. He said, now, John, you're 2 years older and you're stronger. You pop the string.
You knew what was coming next.
He struggled. He couldn't pop it. Then he gave it to me. And I struggled and I couldn't pop it. He took it back and he started, he put the cord string in the palm of his hands. And he began to rub his hands together.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the more he rubbed, the more unraveled the cord string became. And in very short order, it was in three pieces. He gave one to Charles, one to John, one to me. He said, now, sons, pop the strings. And very little effort, all three of us popped it. He said, now, let this be a lesson to you for as long as you live. Don't you let the little disagreements that crop up among you cause so much friction until it separates you. Because if you do, the world will pop you apart, and you may never know why. Those kinds of lessons were taught to us throughout life. They're just relishing doing things like that. And I learned so much from him. So I really admired him greatly. Now, politically, this may sound strange to you, but on the state level, my favorite.
Okay.
It was William Jennings Bryan Dorn. I used to come up, he and his wife, Millie,
mm-hmm.
were just absolutely great friends, big supporters. When I took kids, when I was running the neighborhood youth corps down in Charleston, took them to Washington on a field trip. This was back in the early 60s. The only people that would meet with them was Strom Thurmond. Fritz Hollins, Strom Thurmond would meet with us. Fritz Hollins and William Jennings Bryan Dorn. Now, Greenwood is a far cry from Charleston.
Right.
But Mendel Rivers, who was a congressman in Charleston at the time, would not meet with the kids. But Brian Doran did.
Wow.
And that started a relationship that lasted just for a long, long time. And, of course, John West is the one that became my mentor in politics. But on the national level, my favorite was Harry Truman.
Harry Truman,
and it still is.
Because?
His fair deal. I've studied the fair deal as opposed to the New Deal. I'm not all that fond of the New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
I am very much in tune with the fair deal. And I think that Truman was just an incredible president. And I'll say for all the people who look at things today, just remember when Truman left office.
Yes.
His numbers were very, very low.
Okay.
When historians started looking back on
what he had accomplished,
he now ranks in everybody. You know, we've had 44 presidents.
Right.
And he's in the top three or five in everybody's book.
Wow. Well, we are here with Congressman James Clyburn. We are discussing his book, Blessed Experiences, Genuinely Southern and Proudly Black. We are going to join South Carolina News, hear a quick word from our sponsors, and then we'll be right back. I hope you won't go away. If you've got a question, give us a call, 229-7984. And after this, at 12:30, he is heading over to the Mays House over there on the Gleams campus, and he'll be signing books and selling books right there at the Mays House. I certainly hope you're going to stop by and see him. Fascinating book. I wish I had finished it, but I did a good test here. So we're going to talk some more when we come back. Don't you go away.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Well, appreciate the nice calls coming in this morning, Congressman Clyburn. People are saying, awesome, that one of your heroes, Everett Dirksen.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I think that if people would get a better understanding of a lot of people if they really took time to talk to them. I think it's very easy, especially in the times within which we live, to form opinions based upon the blogosphere or something of that sort.
But if or you really, 2 minute sound bites.
Oh, sound bites can be very ruinous to relationships. But I am who I am. I'm a pretty well-rounded guy, and Dirksen was one of my heroes.
That's great. That's great. Well, I wanted to talk about one of the things in the books, and this is to tempt you to buy the book. I mean, this is I picked out a couple of things that I thought we could talk about. When you decided to run for office for Secretary of State, and first I need to ask you, why the heck did you pick Secretary of State?
Well, I picked that office because I'm living in South Carolina, and of course, as you will tell throughout the book, my whole thing was I was all about breaking barriers. I always wanted to go to Congress, and my thing was, how do I lay a foundation to do that? If I could get elected to an office that was not threatening to anybody. I mean,
right.
Nobody should be threatened by who the Secretary of State is. You may have a problem with the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, but the Secretary of State is an administrative office.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get 48% when I ran for it. But
Two times
for Secretary.
Third time was for Congress. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
So my thing was that if I could get elected there, then in one of those off year elections, I would run for Congress.
Yeah.
Well, I'm right now today where I always dreamed of being. I'm one of those people who is actually living out his dreams.
Living the dream, right?
I am living the dream. Ever since I was a little boy, I wanted to be in the Congress.
That wasn't what your dad had in mind.
No, my dad thought I should be a minister and followed him into the ministry. And that was my plan when I left home. I thought I would. Of course, you know, a lot of ministers get to Congress, too.
Because they're good orators, right?
Well, you know, John Lewis was one of my favorite people. John is a minister. Ed Towns, Emmanuel Cleaver. All these guys are pretty good congresspeople, and they did it from the ministry. And so I guess I could have done that, too. Except that I kept listening, and I never heard the call. I decided that I would do something different. But I told my dad that I had decided against going to the seminary. He simply said to me on that day, "Well, son," he said, "I suspect the world would much rather see a sermon than to hear one." And with that, we never discussed it again.
That's pretty awesome. I also liked in the book, there's a short piece where you came home from school one day and one customer of your mom's in the beauty shop asked you how you were doing and what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yes. This lady had grown up over in Lee County with my mother on an adjoining farm. My mother out in the Brown Town section of Lee County, Lizard Man country.
Yeah.
Well, my mother required that every day after school we would have to stop in the beauty shop to tell her to report in.
Right.
And so while I was reporting in this day, this lady was there. And she turned around when I walked in. I spoke to everybody, and she heard my voice. She turned around, and she says, "My Lord, how you've grown since I've seen you."
And your voice has gotten
and
lower.
And your voice is changed. What do you want to be when you grow up? And I started telling about my dreams. I wanted to finish high school. I was going to go to college. And I wanted to be in politics and government and that kind of stuff. She said, "Son, don't you ever let anybody else hear you say that again." Well, that night, my mom's closed the beauty shop. She came back and called me to the kitchen table. And she said, "Don't you pay any attention to what that lady said today. You stay in school. You study your lessons. You stay out of trouble. Things are going to change. And you can be anything that you want to be." And I'll never forget that lesson.
And
I wish my mother had lived to see it. But
That's kind of like my dad. My dad died before I ever got into radio or did any of these things. And, you know, when my mother was here one time, she stood here and she looked around and she goes, "Your dad would have loved to have seen this."
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's just one of those things.
Right.
But one of the things that I thought was very interesting is the fact when your dad, when you were campaigning, you ran across a guy named, or that they were looking for, you ended up talking about down in Yemisi, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, yeah.
With Reverend Dixon.
Dixon. Reverend Dixon called me one day and said that he was president of the Ministerial Alliance down in Hampton County.
Mm-hmm.
And they had been talking about my campaign. I'm running for Secretary of State. This was 1978, and wanted to know if I would come down and meet with the Ministerial Alliance to discuss my campaign. And so I went down. We had this prearranged place to meet right outside of Yemisi, and when I drove up, he was there. And we spoke. As we were getting back in the cars, he turned to me and he said, "Look, you have a kind of unusual last name."
Clyburn.
Clyburn. He said, "I never heard that name but one time before in my life, and it belonged to a man who went to school with me at Morris College."
Mm-hmm.
I never knew his first name, he said, "but we all called him E.L. Would you happen to have known him?" I said, "Yeah, I know him." I said, "That's my daddy." He said, "Well, no, it's strange. He was one of the smartest guys in the class, but for some strange reason, he dropped out. He never came back for his senior year." Well, that was news to me. My daddy had dropped out. I couldn't believe that. And so when I left that meeting that night, I went to a phone booth. We didn't have cell phones back then. I went to a phone booth and I called my dad and I told him that I was where I was and I was on my way back to Columbia. And on my way back, I was coming through Sumter. I wanted to talk to him.
He was ill.
He was ill. Yes. The dad had prostate cancer, and you know, I knew he was ill. And, but this was just something I had
blew
to talk
your
to
mouth.
Him. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to his house around midnight, and I told him what I had just heard. And that's when he told me that he had grown up in Kershaw County at a time when there was no school for blacks beyond the seventh grade, that he had repeated the seventh grade three times, and the teachers finally said to him,
you're hurting the other students because you're too far advanced.
Too far advanced, right. Yeah, and so they wouldn't let him come back. So he went and got a job. He got a job in a bakery shop, but he kept reading and kept studying everything that he could. And eventually, he took a college entrance exam after he and my mother got married. He passed the exam and was admitted to Morris College. And that was the incentive for moving from Camden to Sumter. So he enrolls at Morris College. And then after his third year, he was called into the office and was told that they had no record of his high school graduation, and under state law, he could not graduate
unless he could produce his diploma. Right.
Well, he didn't have one to produce. So that's why he didn't go back the third year. And
that was very painful.
This was very painful to him. This was like
maybe off a scar.
It was early in the year because it was. I remember being a little cool that night because my dad died in June. This was within months of his dying, and he was about to die, but my not ever knowing this. And so when I repeated this story of one day speaking to a group over in Sumter, not far from Morris College, I didn't know it, but sitting behind me was the president of Morris College. I really believe that if I had known Dr. Richardson was sitting back there, I never would have told this story. But I did, and he came up to me afterwards, and he said to me, he said, you know, says, is that, I never heard that before. Is that really true about your dad? I said, I don't know why my dad would lie about that. I says, it happened the same way I told you. He says, okay. So 3 or 4 days later, I got a phone call from Dr. Richardson saying to me that he had gone into the archives at Morris College and he had found my dad's records. He says, everything I said was true. And he was taking this to the Board of Trustees and he was going to correct that error. And sure enough, the Board of Trustees voted to award my dad a Bachelor of Theology degree, which was awarded 20 years almost to the month after he died. So he finally got his degree, which I have hanging on my office in Washington.
You know, I think that's one of those stories that would be always be an inspiration, you know, to be able to look at that. And, you know, when things are tough or when you think you can't make it any further, you look at that.
Absolutely,
and it's bittersweet.
Yeah.
That your dad didn't get to know that he got it.
Yep, but I got that. It's framed along with the program from the commencement because it was a commencement exercise, and I went. And what was so interesting about when I told my kids about this, my daughter Jennifer, a public school teacher, was getting her third degree, education specialist degree, on the same day and at the same time that my dad was going to be awarded. His degree. And so I said to her, I says, look, I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to come to your commencement. I've been to two already. I can come to this one because I got to go to Sumter and receive this degree from my dad. She looked at me. She says, I'm going to Sumter too.
So she didn't go to her own graduation.
They had to mail her degree.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an awesome story.
So all the kids were there, grandkids, my brothers and their children, and John's children were not there, but Charles's children and grandchildren were all there.
Wow. You know,
and
the
pictures in the book, the pictures from that graduation.
Now, the other story that coordinates very well with this story, although it wasn't a secret, is your mom's story about going to college, about having her beauty shop, about working, and then your house burning down after she'd gotten her diploma.
Absolutely. Yeah, my mom's...
What a rebel. She was a rebel.
She really was.
You call her a renaissance woman.
I call her a renaissance woman.
But I think she was a rebel.
She was, to some extent. I mean, compared to my dad, yes, she was a big rebel. But anyway, my mom's wanted to have a college degree. She went to beauty school first, opened a beauty shop.
In the front of your house.
In the front of the house.
Which actually was the parsonage, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And the front, what would have been the front bedroom of the house, she turned that into to a beauty shop and hired, she had three operators.
Mm-hmm.
When she passed away, she had 16 operators. She had a very successful business. But anyway.
But on the way, all the things she did.
She did, yeah. She first started selling...
laundry.
What we would call
toiletries.
Toiletries. For Lucky Heart, Blair products, they're gone
and
now.
The red wagon.
And had a little Greyhound wagon that she filled up with all of this stuff and would pull it all around Sumter.
It made y'all walk. It made y'all walk or ride
with her.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Sometimes Charles was so small, put him in part of that wagon and pull him. I mean, this was just an incredible woman. And she did that until she could raise enough money to go to beauty school.
Mm-hmm.
And then she graduated beauty school, opened the beauty shop, and she got the business started. And then she enrolled at Morris College.
And she used to take y'all with her to classes if there was nobody to watch you.
Absolutely.
Yep.
In the summer months when we were not in school, because she went straight through and graduated in three years. Going to summers. We'd be out there playing on the under the window where she was up in class.
You couldn't do that today.
No, you can't. Yeah. No, you can't. But some colleges are getting back to having nurseries and that kind of stuff in the schools. But back then, we would play out on the yards. She graduated in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
I was 13 years old, John 11 and Charles 9. But when she graduated, everybody thought that she was going to close this beauty shop and she was going to go teach school.
In fact, she was mandated by the college to do that, wasn't they?
Absolutely.
Told her they made a, if you don't do this, we won't give you your degree type thing. Yeah.
Right. She framed it. Hung it on the wall in the beauty shop.
Never used it.
Never used it.
She was a businesswoman back before there really
Absolutely.
Were businesswomen.
Hey, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's one little story I'll tell today that I didn't put in the book. And when somebody asked her one day, why she had done that. And she looked at it, she says, well, I think that I can earn much more money in this business than I could teach in school. And she did. And she says, and of course, the IRS got to take my word for how many heads come through here.
Fascinating story. This, we are discussing his book, Blessed Experiences, Genuinely Southern and Proudly Black. I mean, but the influences of your parents to your future, growing up like this. You know, the other thing that impresses me, and when we think about kids growing up today, you had two parents, and they were vitally involved in your life, and
Absolutely.
They were concerned about, like your mother making you come in and tell her what happened in school that day.
Right.
I remember reading that your dad made you read, what was it, the newspaper?
Newspaper every evening, and we had to recite a Bible verse every morning. He never told us to read the Bible. He just said that every morning before you put the fork to your lips, you must recite a Bible verse. And you can't say the same one twice. And on the day that he laid down the rule, he took Jesus' whip off the table. And then every evening before retiring to bed, after you finish your homework, we had to share with him or my mother, sometimes both of them, a current event. We didn't have television, but the newspaper, the Sumter Daily Item at that time was an afternoon paper. It was delivered there every afternoon, and we had to share with them a current event. And so you had to read the newspaper in the afternoon, and the morning before, I remember many times jumping up in the morning, rushing to the breakfast table, looking in the Bible, getting a verse that I could remember. But you usually had to read that at night to remember the Bible verse, because you had to recite it. You didn't read the Bible verse. You had to recite it.
You had to memorize it.
You had to memorize it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those kinds of disciplines I grew up with. And still to this day, almost every speech I make, if you listen close enough or if you really pay attention, is grounded in something biblical.
And that's what's missing in our world today.
I think so. And that's what this blessed experiences, as I've said often, comes from the tune Blessed Assurance. It is about experiences. A professor said to me one time in my sophomore year at South Carolina State, young man, he said to me, you will never be any more nor will you ever be any less than what your experiences allow you to be. And what I try to tell people all the time, part of our purpose in life, especially those of us who serve in government, we ought to create environments within which children can have good experiences. Because if children have good experiences, the old poem, children learn what they live.
Yes.
If a child lives with love, the child learns to love. If a child lives with hate, the child learns to hate. And so, to me, that's what it's all about, creating conditions under which children can have good experiences. And I think it'll solve so many problems. And if you really think about that, the policies we're doing, just like the test I applied to this book, will those 10th graders understand it? And you have to ask yourself sometimes, will this policy benefit children? Will it provide an opportunity for a good experience for our children? And the adults will take care of itself.
Yes, but you know what? If we don't get our adults to realize the experiences and the importance of raising our children, your mom and dad were totally committed to you three boys.
Sure.
And they were also committed to providing a better life.
Sure.
And that is one of the things that it just impresses the heck out of me in this book. That is the direction that you took. I think it's terrific.
Thank you.
One quick story, and then
sure.
I have a couple other questions. I love the time when you graduated from Mather Academy. Right. And let's see, they were going to do a march, and you guys were dressed nice, and you thought you would just sit back and just watch what everybody else was doing at this time. It was a march in Columbia, I think.
Oh.
And what was his name? Newman?
Reverend Ida Quincy Newman.
Right.
Yeah.
Called you over there and just wanted you to come over and see what the Mather students were doing.
Right.
And this is in the beginning of the book. And so somehow you got involved in that march.
Yeah.
And you got arrested.
Yep.
And there were 187, I think it was, that got arrested.
Absolutely.
And so one kid came over to you and said, when do you think we'll be getting out of here?
Yeah.
I love this line.
Well, that's great. I said to the young man, I says, and this is one of the vocal ones that day, who just had to go to jail, and all of a sudden he got pretty nervous around 2 o'clock in the morning. I said to him, I says, we're going to be getting out just as soon as Reverend Newman raises the bail money. He's out there raising the bail money. He says, we'll have to get out
by morning.
So he came back to me a little while later. He said, Clyburn, who did you say was out raising the bail money? I said, Reverend Newman, Ida Quincy Newman. He said, well, is he that little man with the goatee? I said, yes. He said, he's back over in that corner over there. Well, Reverend Newman was in jail, too. I didn't realize it. And so it was 3 days later before we got out of jail. I learned a great lesson that day.
What lesson did you learn?
That all of us have roles to play. My role was to go to jail. Reverend Newman's role was to raise the bail. And he couldn't do that in jail.
It was a great story. It was a great, it was a little story, but it was a great story.
Yeah, thank you. That, Every time I think about that, it's just funny.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is you're going to serve another term.
Yes.
Yes.
If I get reelected.
Yeah, if you get reelected. Well, I think you will. But anyways, we'll put the race out there. Okay. So you will be serving another term. And you've already told me on another interview that the itch has left you to be a college president or an ambassador.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you thinking that you would like to do?
Boy, you remember things, huh? You took notes. I don't know. Probably spend my time playing golf. There was a time when I really, really would have left Congress to be president of South Carolina State.
Yeah.
But I think I've gotten I've scratched that itch. And I never really aspired to being an ambassador. My wife would not take kindly to people feeling that they have free access to her house.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, there you go. There's a reason on that one. But what else is left on your bucket list?
Well, I think that for my time is up, I might go back to teaching.
I think you should teach a class in true politics.
Right.
Not civics, not social studies, but politics and the art of the negotiation, because politics is all about negotiating.
Absolutely. Yes? Absolutely. Yes. That's what it's all about. You know, a gentleman, one of the people who sent in a reaction to this book to Amazon.com, he said he was from Rock Hill, South Carolina, 75 years old. Said he had read this book, and he had come to the conclusion that this book should be read by every high school student, especially throughout the South. And when I saw that, I said, well, I really passed the test on this book. This is the kind of stuff I would love to teach, because I really believe that if people could see that you can apply the game of life to sport. If you look at a game of football and you see when the team goes into the huddle and you know they're getting their heads together as to what play to run.
Right.
Sometimes the play won't work.
Right.
And there are times when you say, wait a minute, let's give the ball away. Let's kick the ball to the other team and see can we get into a better position. Let's go on defense for a little while and hopefully we'll get a better field position for the next time we get the ball. That's what and getting people to understand you apply that sort of thing to life. And I really believe it's the kind of way that people ought to be taught politics.
This is WCRS. We're going to go over just a minute here. You know, that is so true. And I have always said that I think boys, particularly, who have gotten to play team sports have been much better at these things.
Yes.
Because they've had the opportunity. And girls have came, actually, I think, from a disadvantage because we didn't play team sports.
That's right.
You know?
That's changing.
That is changing now. But it's been a big disadvantage.
Sure. I spent some time last night, a significant amount of time, with Asia Wilson. Mm-hmm. The young lady who became number one in the country, who's now going to the University of South Carolina.
Right.
I spent some time with her dad last night, and we were talking about Asia and how he just took away from his business to coach her and to train her. And he has made her the number one high school basketball player in the country. I think that she participating in team sport, I think she's going to be a fantastic leader. Not only do I know her dad, but I knew her grandfather, who was a minister there. In fact, he was chaplain at the VA hospital in Columbia when my wife was a librarian there, and they were big friends. So you were talking about my parents. Well, the same thing with to watch her today and to watch how she went through this whole process, and to have known her grandparents and now know her parents. but she's being taught a team sport. It's one thing to be a golfer or
well, that's a an individual,
player.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
Individual stuff.
Yeah,
but if you ever learn how to carry out your assignments in order to make sure that the team succeeds,
exactly,
then you have a long way toward making things work in life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Congressman Clyburn, it has been an absolute delight to have you on my show here today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And this is just a delightful environment. It makes me want to just talk on.
Okay. Well, you'll have to come back and we'll have you talk on some more.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
That's right. Well, listen, you got to be over there 12:30 this afternoon over there at the Mays House. Congressman Clyburn will be there. His wife is here. They're going to have a delightful time checking out the Mays House. They want you to come by and get your book signed. They also will have books for sale right there. The book is Blessed Experiences, Genuinely Southern, Proudly Black by James Clyburn. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye, everybody.